Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is a backlash against the transgender community coming mainly from the right, which has fueled right-wing politics. The rhetoric is framed in fear, a lack of understanding, and sometimes mis- and disinformation, along with some simple and very basic philosophical differences. But it shouldn't be forgotten that the subjects of this political football are, after all, people. And those individuals have a path through life most of us will never tread. Being the object of these discussions, which are often attacks, isn't easy. And Ben Green says that they are part of an all-out war, the object of which is to make transgender people feel so beaten down, hopeless, and joyless that they just quit fighting back. Green takes a different approach, a joy-centered approach, and writes about it in his book, My Child is Trans, Now What? Ben Green is an openly transgender man, a speaker who has traveled the country talking on this topic, and an LGBTQ plus advocate, and he joins us to spread some of the light, some of the understanding that he does in his talks, and to help us understand his joy-centered approach to dealing with a topic that is so politically fraught. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be here.
You're welcome. Your mission is to bring joy and humor and humanity into discussions about trans lives and trans parenting, which cannot be easy, at least at the beginning. But even the most progressive parents may feel this twinge when their child tells them they are transgender.
Yeah.
Mostly because they fear for the future for that
Absolutely.
Child. What was your parents' reaction?
Yeah. So, you know, I came out 10 years ago, which was a time and a place where transgender was not really a word anybody was using. And so when I first came out, my parents, I think their reaction was the best it could have been with the resources they had at the time, which was to say, we have no idea what that means. We don't really know what to do, but we love you. So we're going to figure it out together. And that was really important.
Yeah,
to
not everybody is so fortunate, I suppose. But the fear that those parents sometimes feel is not unlike the fear that parents of gay children feel when their children come out to them because of societal pressures and what this will mean for how they have to conduct their lives. Is the fear justified? Is the fear for trans children justified?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes yes and sometimes no. I think the big thing that parents want is, I want my kid to have a good life. I want my kid to grow up. I want them to, you know, have a family or have success. We have specific ideas for what a good life is, and we want our kid to have that. And so much of the way that we talk about trans people and about trans kids, I find myself getting really frustrated that our conversations begin and end at suicide statistics. Most people are very familiar with that 40% of transgender young people have considered or attempted suicide. We know these statistics, but we don't talk about why to support trans kids in a positive way of what lives they might be able to build. So a lot of parents are terrified, even if they are totally on board, because it hasn't occurred to them that their kid is going to get to grow up and have a fulfilling life, right? I didn't know I was going to get married. I didn't know I could have a career. I didn't know I could write a book. I thought I would be maybe 21 years old and then I would just kind of disappear off the face of the earth. So a lot of parents are terrified, and for good reason. The world feels terrifying and there's a lot of hostility towards trans kids right now.
And that's based in fear of the other. But we talked about the parents being afraid. I'm sure it's a scary prospect for the individual who finds themselves to be transgender, not only to come out, but just the idea that that's what they are.
Absolutely.
So how do you find the joy in that?
Yeah. It's a great question. And it took a lot of practice, honestly. You know, when I first came out for years, I was just like, this is so horrible. I'm so afraid. And as I started to look for it, as I started to build more community and surround myself with people who loved me for who I was And I got to see the depth of experience of the world that I was having, right? It kind of feels like we have all these norms, these social rules, these things that are standard of, you know, I was born a girl in Connecticut, and here's a very specific trajectory of what your life can look like. And we're all doing this performance of the roles and norms and doing what we're supposed to be doing. And when I transitioned, that's one of like the biggest rules to break, right? Is, well, you're a girl in Connecticut, be a girl. And I said, no, thanks, I'm good. And so I tried to take the gender test. I got an F on it. You know what I mean? So I said, I don't want to do the performance anymore. And all of a sudden, I stepped backstage and I got to look at all the different moving pieces. And I feel like I've gotten to create my own life because I broke the biggest rule. Nobody really cared about the little rules I was breaking, you know, about what clothes I was wearing or what jobs I was looking at. They were just really confused by kind of the whole thing I had going on there, which sometimes was frustrating, but meant that I had a lot of freedom to say, I'm starting from square zero. What kind of man do I want to be? Getting to create myself has been incredibly joyful. Find other people who are fighting for change, who are learning to create themselves in ways that are totally different than what I'm doing. There's a lot of color that transition adds to the human experience that brings me a lot of joy. And looking for the good news stories, looking for the allies, you find joy if you choose to look for it every day. It won't come naturally.
There's also fear on the other side, the people who are are putting up roadblocks to your success or to your ability to live your authentic life. There are roadblocks, and some of that is based in fear, it seems to me, because we aren't exposed. We haven't been traditionally exposed, and we don't know what this is all about. But some of it is based in morality and religious thought and disdain, even hatred. Why? From your point of view, why do you think that's coming at you?
Yeah, I think there are two big features that are driving it. The first is a specific movement of Christian nationalism. Organizations like the Heritage Foundation that are specifically religious organizations that say we want to go back to traditional Christian family structures, we want to go back to traditional Christian patriarchy, and trans people and LGBTQ people more broadly are a threat to that because we say there should be another way for LGBTQ people and for everybody. Everybody should get to choose.
But there's nothing in the Constitution about transgender people. There's nothing. Jesus never spoke about transgender.
That's
true. You can put your money on that. He never spoke about transgender people.
Yeah, it's true.
And they were around.
Yeah, we have been here as long as humans have been alive. Right. There have been examples of transness in most major religious texts and most major mythology. I mean, the Greek gods were changing their gender to prank each other literally all the time. And the Norse god Loki became a woman to get pregnant as a prank on the other gods, then gave birth to a horse, but we don't need to talk about that, and then became a man again. Yeah. Transness and queerness have existed for so long, and a lot of it, honestly, is convenience. People need something to get angry about, and it's a lot of politicians have said it's so much easier for me to, quote-unquote, fix this than it is for me to fix that my constituents can't afford their groceries,
right,
that they're wondering why they don't have a job anymore. Well, they need somebody to point the finger at, and right now, that's us.
I'm not a numbers person, but this has always been curious. I've always been curious about this because there are about 2.8 million people in the United States, age 13 and higher, who identify as transgender. That's out of a population of I had to write this down because I can't remember numbers.
Yeah.
That's out of a population of 347 million people in the United States. That is 0.8% of the population in comparison. About 5.1% of the population is said to identify as gay, lesbian, or bisexual, or about 13.5 million people. African Americans make up about 12.4% of the population. Veterans, 4.7% of the population. Native Americans, 1.3% of the population. The only subset of the population that I could find that was smaller than the 0.8% of the population occupied by transgender people are the number of people in our population named Michael, which is about 0.3% of the population. And we have a very popular name, us Michael. That brings us to a twofold question. Why is such a small segment of the population viewed with such alarm? And since transgender people make up that small piece of the population, does that make them even more vulnerable to attacks?
Absolutely. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is for listeners to understand how small this community is, because we have that availability bias in our brains. The more we hear about something, the more we think it happens, right? There was that minute in January where there were like 4 plane crashes in a row. Nobody wanted to get on a plane, right? Even though that's 4 plane crashes and millions of flights a day, doesn't happen actually that often. So like trans sports is a really good example that the amount that we hear about it, we assume that it is literally everywhere. I spent the last 5 years living in Missouri, and I was a very front lines political advocate. I was at the Capitol every single week. In 2023, we had 8 anti-trans sports bills proposed in the state of Missouri. They already have a process for trans athletes. They have to apply to a certain department in the state sporting association, and on a case-by-case basis, it's reviewed. So we know how many trans athletes there are in Missouri. It's 5. When I gave my testimony, I said, this is more than 1 bill per child in this state. And most of our schools in the rural areas are going to 4 days a week. And so many of our kids are below the poverty line. But we are writing more than 1 bill per child about athletics to essentially solve a problem that doesn't exist. So a lot of this is just saying, well, I can talk about these bills. I can build this anger because it's a small enough community. Who's really going to care? Who's really going to stand up for them? I think it does make us more vulnerable that we're smaller. And I think we're also smaller because we're more vulnerable. I think that if it were safer to do so, we'd see a lot more people who were coming out or who would had lived long enough to come out, right? The AIDS epidemic killed millions of LGBTQ plus people who should have been here today to say, I can guide you through this. I can be a mentor. I can be a role model. So much of our community isn't here because it hasn't been safe to stick around for them.
I want to talk about trans athletes a little bit later on in the program. Yeah. And I also want to spend some time talking about your personal story. But I'm just curious, given the pressures that trans people have to endure, and the backlash they are experiencing on a daily basis, which is more scary, staying in the closet and not presenting as your authentic self, or coming out on the stage and saying, this is who I am?
Yeah. To me, no matter what it might cost, to have lived a life as my genuine self, to have been able to come home to my body, to build a home in my own life, will have been worth it every time, no matter what it might bring, no matter how long or short my life might get to be. I love getting to live as myself. I would choose that every single time.
Explain to me what it was like for you to look into a mirror as the girl that you were.
Yeah, it was honestly terrifying and really confusing because we weren't talking about it in my school at all, right? So I was going through puberty and things were changing. And my middle school, all the people jokingly called it puberty jail. And they said, oh, everybody hates puberty. Puberty's horrible. So I knew that I looked in the mirror and I did not want to be alive. I knew that I was going through what I now understand to be dissociation, but at the time felt that I would look into my eyes and I had literally no recognition. It felt like I was falling out of my body, often in a way that I couldn't connect. You know, it would take me sometimes hours to come back to myself. So it was really frightening and isolating.
And that may be part of the answer to my next question, which I will ask after the break. And it has to do with kids going through phases in their lives where they don't know who they are and they experiment. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to Ben Green, a transgender man, LGBTQ plus advocate, author of My Child is Trans, Now What? He also has a Substack called Good Queer News. Some of the fear or some of the objections to particularly transitioning physically, medically.
Yeah.
For young people who feel that they are not in the right body, is that children go through phases. One day they're really into it, and everything is life-shattering. You must be this. It's life-shatteringly important that you must be this. And the next day, that's forgotten, and you've moved on to something else that is equally life-shattering. You had an experience of going through this yourself. So how did you know that it wasn't a phase for you, that you weren't going to change your mind? Because there have been instances where people have gone through the medical surgeries and then they've, this is not who I am.
Yeah, it's a great question and one that's on a lot of people's minds, so I'm really glad you're asking about it. One of the big things I'll say about regret rates is that there was a study that was done recently of over 70,000 transgender people, the largest ever study of the trans community. Results came out earlier this year through the U.S. Transgender Survey. And they asked people, did medically transitioning improve your quality of life? Are you more satisfied with your life? 93% said yes. That is a medical miracle. When you think about things like knee replacement surgery that have an almost 50% regret rate, yet we let people do knee replacement surgeries all the time. Weight loss surgeries, all kinds of Botox and things that go wrong. We don't have any conversations about whether people regret them. We might think it privately, but we say, oh, well, it's knee replacement. You got to do what you got to do. So I do want to highlight that the regret rate, again, while we talk about it an outsized amount, is quite low. And the bar for when a person under 18 is given medical treatment, even before all of the legal barriers, was very high, right? Somebody comes out before 13, we want to give them space to explore, to change their mind, to figure out who they are. When a kid before puberty comes out to you, all you do is say, great, I love you. I'm right here with you. You're in the driver's seat. How can I support you? A haircut, a change of clothes, a change of name. Maybe they'll go on something called puberty blockers. That's really rare. And that's a pause button for a couple of years to give them even more time so they don't have to do something permanent. And then once they're 15, 16, we can say, okay, hormone therapy might be a right answer to you for you to help you go through the puberty that your peers are going through rather than go through the wrong puberty the first time. So I couldn't get hormone therapy until I was about 21 years old. I had top surgery when I was 19, so I had a double mastectomy to make my chest appear very masculine. And I knew I wanted these things. And in particular, top surgery, I was going through this puberty. I was watching my body change in just horror. And I was missing out on my life because I wouldn't wear a t-shirt, so I would not exercise. I was a theater person, but I wouldn't dance. I loved to dance, but I would not dance because I hated the way my body felt. I would shower with the lights off or with a t-shirt on, and I wouldn't hug people. I didn't hug anybody from 2016 to 2019 because I felt so horrible at this reminder of what my body felt like. It was maybe a side hug, but I just hated it. And I'm like, I'm a squishy kind of guy. I love a hug, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And when I finally got top surgery, the best way I can explain it is that I came home to my body for the first time. I feel like I live in my body now, and that's amazing. And so when we talk about medical transitioning, you know, it's about making a plan that feels right for what somebody needs. And there's a lot of standards to make sure that's right. And we can talk about that if that's interesting. But it's about building a home in our bodies, which is all any of us are trying to do.
I mean, I've never heard anybody express it so well.
Yeah.
And my understanding of this is peripheral at best. But you talked about hormone blockers, and you talked about puberty blockers, or hormone therapy and puberty blockers, and there are some states that have and are continuing to pass laws to make those things illegal.
Yeah.
Given what you just talked about, looking in the mirror and not seeing the person you are and the pain that must have caused you, and the pain that you were willing to endure to become the person that you are today. Talk to me about what this means, the inability to continue treatment that you're already on or to start treatment that you need to become the person that you are, because somebody who is untouched by this has passed a law.
I mean, it's devastating. It feels like there is a target painted on my back. It is a message that says, I do not see you. I do not care about you. You are not a person in my state. You are not a person in my community. I do not, you know, believe you. I do not see you. It hurts and it's terrifying. And a lot of families are just saying, okay, what do I need to do to protect my kid? Where do I need to go? Do I need to uproot my entire life? Do I need to move my family? Do I need to leave all of my friends so that my kid can have a chance to keep living, so that my kid can have a chance to come home to themselves? And I think it's reasonable to say we want to make sure we have the right guardrails in place. We want to make sure that we talk to kids about risks, that we have impactful conversations with families about what is the meaning of these treatments and who are they right for. And that means that every individual person, there's going to be a different answer to that question. And these laws strip us of the ability to figure out where this is the right answer for somebody's journey. You know, it doesn't say, hey, let's make sure that everybody's really, you know, we're really certain they're getting what they need. We're saying, I know what you need, and it's not what you want.
The people who are passing these laws, who endorse these laws, who feel that these laws are necessary, will tell you that they are doing it to protect children. And if they truly believe that, then I suppose you have to step back and say, well, thank you, because you are following through on something that is a true belief. Do you think they truly believe that, or is there another agenda attached to this?
Yeah, so in Missouri, the sponsor of our gender-affirming care ban, one of the sponsors, is also one of the loudest no votes anytime Missouri attempts to pass a ban on child marriage. I was sitting with him in a hearing, and somebody said, it's outrageous to me that you all talk about protecting children, and this is a state where child marriage is legal. And the bill sponsor said, do you know anyone who's been married as a child? And we had this kind of reaction that I thought he was going to say, that doesn't even happen. It's not a relevant law. You're kind of like, that's a straw man argument. I expected him to take that position, which would have been an interesting one, but not entirely wrong. But instead, he said, do you know anyone who's been married as a child? Because I do. And they're still happily married. And it was horrifying that he was essentially saying, I want to protect children. They should be allowed to get married as children as well. I mean, Missouri is...
So how do you explain this? Is this ignorance? Is it meanness? Is it something else? What is it?
It's largely based in faith. Even though we're supposed to have the separation of church and state, Missouri people are, you know, because of the supermajority they have, they're not wasting a lot of time, you know, pretending that it's not about what it's actually about. And so I have heard people quoting the Bible in the state house. I have had people say, you know, it's just not right. It is spitting in the face of God, saying things that I won't repeat on air because they are hurtful in a way that I, like, as a trans adult who has lots of great, you know, fortitude resources, even I will never fully recover from. But it's very faith-based. The child marriage thing is saying that if an adult gets a child pregnant, they should get married so that that child isn't giving birth out of wedlock. It's a very far-right religious thing. And even when people think, oh, it's not about religion, it's not about faith, if you dig deep enough, the people who are starting the conversations, who are trying to get you to be angry about athletes, who are trying to get you to quote-unquote protect kids, they are doing it for a religious reason. Even if the people on the ground, the everyday people, don't think it's religious, all the ones who want us to be having these conversations and the ones writing these bills are absolutely doing it for religious reasons.
And because they think they're right.
Yes.
And you think you're right.
Yeah.
Is there a middle ground?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, truthfully, I don't even know if a lot of them believe that it's right. I've had one-on-one conversations with legislators where I say, hey, do you know about the impact this is having? Do you know there's four transgender athletes, or that, you know, this whistleblower thing in Missouri has no backing to substantiate it? And they say, yeah, I've heard that. I'm really sorry to hear that. this is what my voters want me to be talking about. Mm. Though there was a quote from Donald Trump himself at a rally in 2023, and he was giving a whole bunch of, you know, talking about policy things that were important to him, and people weren't really reacting that much. And he said something about trans athletes, an offhanded conversation, and he went crazy. And he said, "You guys go so crazy for the transgender stuff. I wish you'd get this excited about something real." He doesn't care about this either. It's what the base is energized about. So I don't actually believe that a lot of people talking about this think that they're right either. They think it will get them votes. They think it will make people angry enough to not ask, why did you vote for a bill that has destroyed my community's water quality?
Part of the key to this, it seems to me, is understanding and compassion and empathy and just letting people live their lives. We don't, the people on the right who are against this and are passing these laws and advocate for the things that we just talked about want to live their lives undisturbed. And so do you. So let's talk about your journey.
Yeah.
In your TED talk, you did a TEDx talk, and you say that you spent about 16 years, these are your words, you spent about 16 years as an ugly and uncomfortable girl until you saw a Facebook post about what trans meant and, quote, everything changed.
Yeah.
Was it really that easy with that eye-opening?
You know, it was and it wasn't. So I used to think that I came out when I was 16, and then my parents were moving out of my childhood house, and I was going through my old bedroom with all my papers, and I found a letter I had written. It was a homework assignment in third grade. We had to write a letter to ourselves, turn it into our teacher, and then we would get it the day that we graduated high school. And I found this letter, and the opening lines of it said, "Let's get one thing straight. You will never like pink. You will never wear a dress. You will never be a girl."
How old was that? Were you
third grade?
Third grade.
And it broke my heart to see that. First, I laughed. I said, "This is so funny that, you know, I said you'll never like pink or wear a dress. That's what I thought being a girl was."
But I like also, pink, by the way.
Yeah, pink is a great color. It complements my skin tone very nicely. But I said, I imagine how many adults had to read that letter, right? I showed it to my parents. I gave it to my third grade teacher, who gave it to my health teacher, who gave it to my middle school health teacher, who gave it to my high school health teacher. All these adults who read that letter and had they known could have said, "I wonder if this kid knows that there's another way." Because I was visibly struggling. I just didn't know with what. And then I saw that Facebook post and it just... it gave me the language. People think learning the word transgender is what makes people transgender. It is the final key to unlock a door to a closet that has been getting more and more full and cramped and painful. So I learned that word and everything made sense. It was like a tsunami wave.
I don't know whether this is in your TEDx talk or in your book or in the numerous interviews that I read that you've conducted with other, other people. But when your parents, I think, first found out about you, evidently they were told by a friend of yours at school who was a boy who was concerned about your mental health, about where you were in your stage of life, and they took you to the hospital where you spent some time, I think 48 hours in a hospital in a locked room because they were afraid that you were going to take your own life. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So this is especially relevant given that yesterday was National Suicide Prevention Day. I was really struggling because I couldn't see a future for myself. And it was, you know, early 2016. So Trump was coming to power the first time. And I just was so isolated and petrified. And I told my best friend, I don't think I want to be alive anymore. I don't think I can do this. And he called my parents. He and his parents showed up to my house. And he and I went to like hang out. I didn't know what was going on. I just figured that his parents wanted to come over and say hi. And then my parents said, you know, his parents told us some pretty disturbing information and we want to make sure you're okay. So we're going to go to the hospital. And my parents didn't know I was trans at the time.
How old were you then?
I was 16. Okay. I came out when I was 16. I didn't come out to my parents for the first, I think, 7 or 8 months. I came out only to that best friend.
And you talked about feeling betrayed by that best friend. Do you still feel that way, or is that a good thing?
I mean, he saved my life. I was furious at him for betraying my trust.
Yeah.
But he did what he needed to do, and he did what I needed him to do, which was to help me get help. And I'm really fortunate. You know, some people will be in a situation like that. And for a trans person of color, that could turn into a life-ending situation, yeah, that the police are coming to do a wellness check and that's not safe. But for me, that was what I needed and to be safe.
That was a dark moment. But the rest of your transition seems to me, at least the way you write about it and talk about it, doesn't seem to be as difficult or dire or negative as it might have been, because you were in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. You were in a high school that, in a health, I think it was a health class, where you talked about.
I was teaching all the different classes about trans inclusion. It was, I'm really
fortunate. You were teaching teachers about trans inclusion. This seems to be very enlightened or very progressive.
Yes. Yeah, I was really fortunate that they showed up for me, and really that they allowed me to show up for myself. You know, I think that I wish that I had had an adult to say, I'm going to be here, I'm going to step in, and I'll build a safe environment for you. My school was really welcoming, and they said, whatever you need, that's fine, you can do that. You want to write a policy, you want to train the guidance staff, go ahead. And so I was able to get support at the cost of a childhood. I grew up, I've been an adult since the day I came out, mm-hmm, in order to build a world where the kids who came after me didn't have to grow up.
How did your peers treat you when they discovered who you are?
Depended entirely on who it was and if they were a girl or if they were a boy. The girls in my school were like, I was so popular overnight, and which was so weird for me because I did not have friends. I asked somebody about it. I said, why do I have so many friends now? This is kind of cool, right? And she said, honestly, it's because we can tell you are so authentic. And this is high school. People aren't telling the truth that much.
Yeah.
And you are telling the truth, even knowing what it might cost. That's really cool. So the girls were largely very compassionate. I think there were probably 3 male students that called me Ben in the entire year and a half that I was out in my high school. The boys were not interested. And that's, I think, larger culturally. A lot of men are afraid to engage with kindness and empathy because of what it might say about them. And I want to say that I think that men should be, encouraged to show up with kindness and empathy for ourselves and for each other. But I definitely found that in my high school. I was not welcome in the boys' bathroom. I was not welcome in the locker room. I had one gender-neutral bathroom that I could use. I had a closet I was able to use to change in instead of the locker room. So I had ways that I felt fine. The girls were great. The boys wanted nothing to do with me. They let me know that I was not one of them.
Yeah. We have to take a break. We're going to talk a little bit about bathrooms and locker rooms in a moment, because we went through our own situation here in North Carolina, mm-hmm, with bathrooms and that. And I want to talk about, even though you're here to talk about the joy in realizing who you are as a human being.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about what you call an all-out war, mm-hmm, against transgender people. We'll do all of that, or try to do most of that, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Ben Green, a transgender man, and the author of My Child is Trans, Now What? He also has a Substack called Good Queer News, where you talk about good queer news. What is that about?
Yeah, it is exactly as advertised. I realized that so many people were only getting this one-sided gloom and doom portrait from the media they were reading, from the news, that was just saying everything's awful and everyone hates us over and over again. And so I decided to start collecting good news, because even if it doesn't lead the headlines, it's still happening. Mm-hmm. And it has turned into not just a source of news, but a space for me to talk about how can we move differently as a movement. How can we talk about mental health and about supporting each other? And how do we engage with the news mindfully? And I am always reminding people, your despair is someone else's business model.
Wow.
And so I've been really trying to change the paradigm of how should news be, you know, engaging ethically with the stories that are happening around us, and not just trying to make people as miserable as possible so they don't stop scrolling.
And yet, even as you write that Substack, Good Queer News, you are talking about the all-out war that you see, that we appear to be engaged in. And in your book, you write, quote, for the LGBTQ plus community, they've come for so many parts of our lives. Our ability to gather safely at gay bars and queer spaces, our ability to perform and enjoy drag shows, our ability to get married or adopt children, and for transgender people, our ability to access life-changing and life saving medical care to help us find home in our bodies, a phrase that you've used earlier in this conversation. Some of those prohibitions have fallen by the wayside. Yeah. Others are being erected even as we sit here this morning. But I want to explore that last one, the growing move to limit access to life-saving medical care to help us find home in our bodies. As I said, I think I said this before, I've never heard anybody express it quite like that. And when you express it that way, it seems to be to be completely understandable, even for the people who are most against this. Why wouldn't you want someone else to feel at home in their own bodies?
Yeah, honestly, it's a question that boggles the mind. That when I talk to the transgender people I know, when I listen to the testimony people give at the State House, I mean, it is just gut-wrenching to hear a kid talk about, all of a sudden, I feel safe. All of a sudden, I recognize myself. And you are literally calling me demonic. And I'm an 8-year-old. And I just want to feel like I get to grow up. I just want to feel like I get to have a body that fits. It breaks my heart to hear people who hear my story and say, I do not see you as a human being.
In your TEDx talk, you have an analogy that you use involving chairs.
Yes.
It's frigging brilliant.
Thank you.
It's brilliant. I want you to go through it if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have two things that I want to highlight, your gender identity and your sex assigned at birth. Sex is body, gender is identity. When we're all born, we're born sitting for the most part either into a stool or an armchair. This represents your sex. Now, most of us, you sit down and you feel the chair, right? Maybe right now you're sitting on your couch, you're sitting in your car. You feel the chair you're sitting in, but if it's comfortable, you stop feeling it. You forget that it's there. Most people don't feel their chair. They are happy to sit in their chair for all of time. They identify as cisgender. Sometimes we feel uncomfortable in our chairs. And it's not just saying, I don't like something about my body, or I wish my chair was a little taller. It's saying, I'm sitting in this chair and this is wrong. That's called gender dysphoria. So if you're uncomfortable in your chair, easiest solution is to just get up and move. That's someone who's transgender. Now, I'm not kicking over anybody else's chair. I'm not saying no one else is allowed to sit in a stool. And I'm not an entirely different person because I moved my chair. I'm the same person with a bigger smile sitting in a chair that's more comfortable. Maybe someone wants to sit in a chair that's a little softer than a stool or a little taller than an armchair. They identify as what's called non-binary, right? There's a whole IKEA of chairs and people can sit anywhere they want to. And it doesn't change what chair you're allowed to sit in. All I care about is that everybody is comfortable where they're sitting. I am not trying to change anybody's gender. I'm not trying to steal anybody's pronouns. I just want to be allowed to sit in this chair and feel comfortable. It's the most comfortable chair I've ever sat in my life. Yeah. Just let me stay in my chair.
Some people like chocolate ice cream. Some people don't.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, there were a lot of barriers that seemed to fall after centuries of barriers against gay people. They seem to fall relatively quickly. And a lot of that, I suppose, is due to television shows like Will and Grace, which showed that these people are not to be feared.
Yeah.
That Sean Hayes can even be funny. and trans people had the same thing going on. There was Transparent, which with the Jeffrey Tambor, which is probably one of the earlier shows. But there have been many, many, many other shows that had trans characters in them, either front and center or as peripheral characters, where their lives were not disastrous, where it showed that they were not something that you
would
be fearful.
Eventually. For so long, it was just kind of you were a victim or a villain.
Why has that exposure, like the exposure to Will and Grace for gay people, why has that not happened for trans people?
You know, I think actually it has. To be honest, when I started as a public speaker in 2019, everywhere I went, I would say, I'm transgender. People were like, oh, what is that? And then they would say, oh, you're transgender, like Caitlyn Jenner. And I had to be like, yes, like Caitlyn Jenner. And slowly over time, I have found no matter where I go, and I go everywhere, rural Iowa, tiny towns in upstate New York, like I'm all over the map. And now I say I'm transgender. People say, oh, like my nephew, like my neighbor's kid, like my sister, like me. The 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon for transgender people is getting a lot smaller. And so I do actually.
You're talking about to a 1 degree Kevin Bacon person.
Oh, wow. That makes me a 2 degree Kevin Bacon person.
There,
oh, yeah. Oh, he sat in this chair. I'm counting that as 1 degree. I'm counting it. You know, I think a lot of people are actually so much more empathetic than they were 10 years ago. People really, I was the first transgender person so many people had met. That's not the case anymore.
You mentioned Caitlyn Jenner, and that seems to be, in many cases, where the rubber meets the road on this issue for people, and that is trans athletes.
Yeah.
And the argument is that men who become trans women and who are athletes are then competing against women who have always been women, and there are biological differences, and it puts them at a disadvantage. Doesn't happen so much in the opposite direction, but in that direction, it seems to be a problem. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So my first and biggest answer is reminding people how small this is, right? In the NCAA, there are 15, not 15%, 15 transgender athletes, and yet they are making policy about trans athletes. In Missouri, we had 5 trans athletes in the entire state. So first, I want to recognize that this is in many ways a solution in search of a problem. And I want to give a hypothetical. People are really worried. The worst case scenario is that we have this surge, particularly of people who are lying. That's a real fear among some people on the right, or a real fear they talk about. I don't know if they really believe it, that people are going to say, oh, well, I'm transgender because I want to win a trophy. First, let's think about that. When you are transitioning, you will change your name legally. You will go on hormone therapy that will make you grow breasts. Do you think somebody is going to grow breasts so that they can win a high school soccer trophy? Does that seem realistic or worth it?
I understand that point of view, and I really am struggling to decide where I come down on this, to be very, very honest with you about this, because although a trans woman who may be an athlete would like to compete, and you want to give that person the opportunity to exercise their talent in that area, does it not put I don't know how to express that. The word is.
Yeah. So people are asking about fairness. And so I want to talk about a little bit of
how do you make it fair on the other side of the equation?
So it's usually case by case, right? There are existing substantial policies to talk about fairness that say you have to be on hormone therapy for this amount of time, because estrogen therapy and testosterone blockers will actively degrade your muscle integrity, your ability to build muscle, your lung capacity. Those are all going down. And the talent of a trans athlete is often due to training. We saw Leah Thomas, her scores went down significantly when she started estrogen therapy, which she had been on for the recommended amount of time. What I'd also say is that sports are about biological differences. And I would encourage us to reflect on whose differences we are allowed to accept, who's allowed to be great, right? Take Michael Phelps. That man is built like a duck, right? He's got webbed feet. His arms are like 9 feet long or something. And there was a cereal box they made a while ago that was all the different analysis of his body that made him the perfect swimmer. Nobody cared that he had like 32 gold medals or some crazy number because of how his body was. They celebrated these differences that he had. But when any woman, not just transgender woman, you know, people like Serena Williams gets accused of being a man every time she wins a trophy. So many women, people say, well, you can't be good at sports. All women must be bad at sports and all men must be good at sports. And so a transgender woman must be better. Sports are about a combination of your biological advantages and about your training. And when we look at the actual data about what hormone therapy does to your body, it brings you down to that level. And that's why they say it should be case by case, to say we want to look at your bone density, we want to look at your muscle mass and make sure that it's fair. So I think it's great to have those policies in place.
I don't want to spend a lot more time on this because this is something that we've talked about in the past, but not with you. And we had our little flirtation here with HB2, which is our bathroom bill. And that is a concern by a lot of people, and politicians who are on the other side of this issue from you say that we need these bills to protect women from people entering a bathroom that is not of the gender of which they were born.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned not being able to change in the locker room and in high school because you were presenting as transgender. What should be the case? What should we do about that?
Yeah. To be really clear, when people talk about protecting women in bathrooms, any bill that is about, you know, bathroom ban for transgender people, the only people thus far who have been directly targeted by those bills have been women who were assigned female at birth, who might be lesbians, who might have short hair. There was just recently in a teenage girl who was followed into a bathroom by a male security officer screaming at her to say, transgender people, you are not allowed in this bathroom. And she had to open her jacket and show her breasts through her shirt to prove that she was allowed to be in that bathroom. That does not sound like protecting women to me. Encouraging people to be bounty hunters and to peek underneath the stalls, no one is safer for that. So I think the answer is privacy, is that everyone just wants to go in and pee in a private closed stall and we don't peek.
And that is the case in bathrooms. But what about locker rooms where you're getting undressed? You're fully naked in a locker room in many cases.
Yeah.
The locker rooms are not designed, or at least the ones that I've been in, are not designed to be private.
Yeah, I think truthfully the answer is that we have more options for private spaces in there for people who choose to use them. So whether that's for a transgender person who would like a little more privacy or for a person who does not like to see other people naked.
But I can understand giving space to the transgender individual who wants to be private. Mm-hmm. But what about the other people who are not in that situation, who are not private, when they're standing in locker rooms in a long, like a football locker room, and everybody's in various states of undress? And there's a transgender individual in there. I mean, do they have a right to their privacy?
Yeah, I think if they feel uncomfortable with having a transgender individual there, they can also step into a private space. And I think we need to change the culture. Like, I think it's not going to be an immediate legislative fix. That's a cultural thing that people think, well, if someone has this body, I must be entirely unsafe around them, right? It's this, why do we have that gut reaction that if your body looks slightly different than mine, I'm unsafe? And I think that that's not something we can answer overnight as a culture. But I think that's something we'll need to figure out to eventually build a world where people feel comfortable either saying, I'm going to step into a private space, or I'm comfortable in the room that I'm in.
You've written this book called My Child is Trans Now What, that's aimed at parents of trans children and helps them through the process with their children, helps them help their children. But you also talk about joy, finding joy in being trans, and you put the joy, and I only have a few seconds left, into a number of buckets.
Yeah.
What are those buckets?
Oh, you're quizzing me in my book. I wrote this a couple of years ago.
That thought occurred to me yesterday when I thought about asking this question. You may not know the answer because you wrote the book several years ago.
Yeah, I think it's being able to see a future for ourselves, being able to feel loved as we are, being able to feel affirmed by the people around us and feel seen as we want to be seen. We want the same things anybody else wants.
You travel the country.
Yeah.
And you talk to people all the time about this. I don't know whether that gets boring for you or tedious for you.
Not at all.
You're very good at it. What would you say to somebody who is in a position that you were in several years ago, or who has a loved one who is in that position? What would you say to them about their fears, about the process, about just their reality?
Yeah, a lot of people are afraid right now. And I'd really say to them, I know how it feels to look at social media, to look at the news and feel like everybody is hateful and they've picked a side and it's not ours. But I got to tell you, I travel everywhere and I meet people who care. In church basements in Georgia, where we hold events in secret because there are too many active militia groups, and entire towns in Iowa that show up at the library to learn about being allies, and webinars in Russia where the parents join under a pseudonym so they don't get caught supporting their trans kids. Every corner of this planet is filled with a bigger and bigger and bigger group of people who care, who want to show up. I know how it feels. Do not give up. A better world is possible. We will continue to fight for it. We must choose joy for ourselves because no one will choose it for us. So you got to look for the good news. Look for the people who make you feel loved. We will get through this moment like we always have. This community knows how to survive because we know how to find the joy.
I have about 10 seconds left. You travel the country. You've written books. You've done TEDx talks on this topic.
Yeah.
Do you think you've changed minds?
I absolutely do. And I look forward to seeing what else I can change coming up.
Ben Green, our guest today. His book is called My Child is Trans, Now What? An advocate, a speaker, an author, and a genuinely cool guy. Thank you for being here. I appreciate that.
Thanks for having me. This has been great.
You're welcome.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.